Instead of peace, as many as 100,000 innocent civilians, including children, have died as a result of U.S. military attacks. Meanwhile, the Patriot Act has been extended, and discrimination against Arab Americans, South Asian, and other immigrants continues. The military budget of $446 billion is draining our resources, which directly affects healthcare, education, jobs, and housing. All over the world, we've heard voices to end the war in Iraq. On Saturday, November 6th, at 12 noon, there will be a march and rally to end occupation in Iraq and bring our troops home. The march will begin at the intersection of Hollywood and Highland and end at the military recruiter's office at Sunset and La Brea.
KPFK welcomes LA Freeway's 9th Biennial Festival of Film, Video, and Media, which asks, how can you resist seeking to engage public skepticism about commercial media and create a consensus for change beyond the outcome of the 2004 presidential election? The festival runs weekends during November in downtown Los Angeles. Works in the festival relate to resistance, including politically charged issues, sexuality, paranoia, and addiction. Festival venues include MoCA, Red Cat Theater, Seja, and Chinatown. Most events are free. For more information, visit the KPFK website at kpfk.org or call area code 213-250-3280. That's area code 213-250-3280 to find out how you can resist.
Yes, still here. Still here. They haven't arrested us yet. And there is no president. There is no president. That's right. 3.5 years, still no president. This is Elections Hotwired. We just changed our name, by the way. From Elections Hotwire, we are now called Elections Hotwired, KPFK's show dedicated to the thievery of the 2004 election, or the possible or alleged thievery of said election, and that is what is the talk all around the town today. 2 minutes past the hour of 2 o'clock on KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in the county of Santa Barbara. I am M.T. Karthik, your guide through this next hour of discourse about what the hell happened, as quickly put it, on Tuesday. I'm still in the context. Wait, I'm counting votes over here. I don't have time to do a radio show. I'm counting votes over here, folks, and that's what you should be doing, too. Turn off your television. The obscenity of the last 2 days flies right in the face of the facts. The facts are these. Sometime past the hour of midnight, Secretary of State of Ohio said there are 250,000 provisional ballots. A few hours before that, a national network said there were 400,000 provisional ballots in Ohio. And between that hour and the hour that the Democrats conceded, that figure was dropped to 135,000 provisional ballots in Ohio. I want to remind all our listeners that we predicted every single step of this thing all summer long. We said Florida would go to Bush. We said Kerry could still win. We said it came down to Ohio. And we said everything. And I didn't say they were going to cheat, but I think Rick Allen might have hinted at it. And sure enough, that's what I think we're faced with today. And we're asking people out there to keep the context. Just keep it. Don't spend the energy legitimizing what a second Bush administration will look like yet. spend the energy thinking about how to bust these guys for cheating, because that will become article number one of our impeachment proceedings at the end of the day. And who has been doing that? Well, some folks you can look up online. Greg Pallast, Hard at Work. Kerry One was the name of his piece yesterday. Kerry One. We have also Tom Hartman. That's H-A-R-T-M-A-N-N. You can catch his stuff over at Common Dreams. Quite a good piece there. Some other people who have been weighing in around the horn. As you surf around the internet, you're going to find a few folks, I think, kicking into this idea. And how about some traditional, sort of more conservative folks? We have Paul Krugman of the New York Times calling for people to stop trying to think that we should appease these newfound evangelical voters out there. Appeasement. Can you imagine it? Appeasement. The left calling for appeasement in the face of this? Radical stuff. Well, you know, I would suggest something slightly different. I would suggest going out in the corner and saying, no, you cannot hate gay people. No, you cannot discriminate against gay people. No, 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 no. You cannot conduct foreign wars. Stop it. Stop it. Appeasement didn't work with Hitler, and it certainly isn't going to work with these clowns. So we encourage this type of behavior. We're keeping the context here at KPFK in the face of all the madness that's going on. Today we are going to go straight to Ohio. First things first. What we have to do is something that, well, we've all become quite used to by now, assuming it still works. Let me see if I can get this thing to happen here. Something that we do each of these programs, and who knows how many more of them there will be. So let us do that right now. Of course, Shanti can be translated to mean peace. That's what we've been doing, and we begin each of our elections hotwired programs. The election has been hotwired, folks, with a little reminder that Pacifica stands for peace. Let us welcome Evan Davis to the program. Evan, welcome to Elections Hotwired.
Glad to be back with you.
We've changed our name. I don't know if you noticed. We dropped the S on the front end, and we added a D to the tail end, and we're hoping that perhaps you can illuminate for us how it is that so many people are suggesting that this thing has been finished when, to my understanding, where you are right now, they haven't finished counting.
That could be a question of the media that's making those proclamations being perfectly in league with the people who stand to benefit from the outcome of the election as they are reporting it. We certainly had our go-arounds here with conservative media outlets like Sinclair Broadcasting and that sort of thing. And Columbus is a media poor town. We don't have any independent media here on the air, just a couple of print journals. But they are collaborating, the independent media people and activists such as Susan Truitt, who I think you'll have on there shortly, are going to be putting together a series of public hearings. That's one action that's taking place. And there are some letter-writing campaigns being launched. We're not taking it quietly.
Well, there are a lot of people writing about it, talking about it all over the Internet. The discussion is going on, and that's encouraging, I suppose. At least we do have some media left that are willing to take this kind of thing on. Let's talk a little bit. I just gave our listeners a bit of a heads-up just to kind of recontextualize how all of this is going and talked about those few hours in Ohio when this number of provisional ballots thing sort of went bouncing around. Maybe you could confirm some of that stuff for us and tell us what the latest figure is for these things and where do we think possibly as many as 265,000 provisional ballots went?
You know, at this point, it might just be constructive to keep changing the number every time we talk about it because it will be matching their game. The night of the vote tallies, when I was at the Democratic Party, or as I refer to it, Depression Central, at one of the hotels downtown, we kept hearing various reports on the commercial broadcast networks. They kept switching channels between CNN and CBS and some of the other networks, and the numbers were different on every one, just about. We heard 400,000 at one point, we heard 500,000. But the most credible source was the Secretary of State himself. When he came on shortly after midnight on CNN, when was talking about 250,000 provisional ballots, and he was certain of that figure. And in fact, he referred to that figure as a reason why he could not call the election at that point. But then by morning, the Franklin County Board of Elections somehow knew that the magic number had been reduced to just over 130,000. I asked how they knew that, and they wouldn't speak on record, but I'll tell you on the air that what they told me was that each and every provisional ballot had been accounted for and hand-counted, not the votes registered, but just the number of ballots had been counted because all of the boards of elections that had received them had reported in. And yet, and apparently that was the number that the Kerry campaign used to base their concession on, because even if all of those votes were for Kerry, it would still not quite bridge the gap between the popular vote tallies for Bush versus Kerry, or so they thought. But yet, the very next morning, the number had jumped again to over 155,000.
Yeah, so there's a lot of funny stuff going on with regards to these provisional ballots, and the concession was fundamentally based on them in Ohio, as a matter of fact, right? Because the math, this whole way, we kind of were expecting this Ohio to go to Kerry and this thing to be over, and the concession came down, at least in the language of it, though he said, it's incredible to me still that they don't see hypocrisy in it, the Democrats. You know, he actually said before conceding that he didn't figure the count would work out, that he believes every vote should be counted. You know, it really the weirdest two sentence combo pack I've heard in a very long time. What do we think is happening really right now? I mean, do you think that this is the work of agency? I mean, that is to say, you've been there, you live there, you're an Ohioan, you know what a divided state it is, you know that there are many conservative people there, there are many people who are not so conservative. Do you think there could be agency in this, or do you think that the chips just fell like so many people in establishment media do?
My intuition and a good degree of hard evidence tells me that there was widespread malfeasance. We just heard a report from one of the Voter Protection Coalition lawyers who was in town to advise voters of their legal rights if they were having trouble at the polls, that a number of the electronic voting machines in Youngstown, Ohio, were recording votes for John Kerry as votes for George Bush. And that those problems had been reported to the boards of elections and they had not been able to fix them or hadn't tried or something like that, and that those problems persisted all day. So if you consider that here in my neighborhood in Columbus, the average number of votes cast on each voting machine was over 200, somewhere between 200 and 300. If you're in a less well-endowed county like Youngstown, perhaps they had fewer machines per precinct, so each of the machines would count more votes. In fact, in some of the African-American neighborhoods, even in town, some of the precincts were divided in such a way so that the machines are counting as many as 1,000 votes. So more is at stake in those places, and it could very well be that those machines in Youngstown had that problem was quite substantial. So I think we do have cultural divisions among Ohioans that range on a number of issues, and I think that a lot of the analysis I've been hearing on KPFK is absolutely correct, that the abortion issue and, in this case, the gay rights issue were specifically used as mechanisms for mobilizing the hardcore evangelical vote. I am amazed, I would always be amazed, to discover that there are so many evangelical voters out there, or people who would elevate that issue among all others, because in average conversations with people, you just don't detect them.
Yeah, and we talked about the invisible hand back in 1988, didn't we? I mean, we all kind of, when Robertson did so well in that one primary, and it was the big shock, you know, was this sort of like fundamentalist hand inside America. And now it's as though, you know, 20 years later, we're supposed to believe that that's what this is. The invisible hand was brought to the booth, you know. And I find it to be something of a stretch when you compare it to the exit polls, really, right? Have you, and there's been some talk about the exit polls. I don't want to make them front and center because I think there's other evidence here of vote fraud and certainly of suppression. But do you think that's the case, that this conversation about exit polling in your state is something that we should be thinking about when you think about your friends and neighbors there, I mean?
Well, there were, I mean, exit polls are certainly far more accurate than pre-election polls, that's for sure. For one thing, the methodology in conducting the exit polls is a lot simpler and difficult to skew. But the what the exit polls were showing here in Ohio is that Kerry was leading by 6%. And then for Bush to pull ahead by 2 or 3%, that's quite a spread. That's quite a spread in the course of just one day.
No, indeed. And that's the same in several other places around the country that we're seeing and that many people have been commenting on, including Palast. Go ahead.
Oh, no, that's all. I'm sorry, I think your other guest was trying to call me just now.
Oh, well, we have her call us. That would make it so easy on me right now, if you want. In fact, what I wanted to do is play this editorial that you put together for our audience. Maybe I can go to that piece right now, and then and while we're doing that, we can come back and talk to Susan Truitt, who is with CASE, Citizens Secure Election. What's the A in that? I've forgotten right offhand. I'm sorry, in the middle.
Citizens Alliance for Secure Elections.
That's it, Citizens Alliance.
If you want to go to the essay, I'll call her and have her call you.
That sounds marvelous. Great. Thank you, Evan Davis.
Okay, great.
And we'll be back with you in just a minute. And that's Evan Davis, who is in Ohio. We're going to hear from Susan Truitt in just a moment, but I wanted to play this again if you missed the midday news. I think it's a nice comment coming from our reporter there, Evan Davis, and I really... Yeah, check this out.
When John Kerry conceded the election of 2004, he did more than offer a gracious blessing to the assumed or apparent victor. By acquiescing in advance of the final vote tally, Kerry effectively disenfranchised all whose votes had yet to be counted. In doing so, he also discounted the sacrifices of tens of millions of voters who waited in lines at the polls, some for as long as 10 hours or more in Ohio, and the tens of thousands of activists who did the work Mr. Kerry's own party was clearly ill-equipped to do, of registering millions of new voters and getting them to the polls. In a virtual repeat of their shameful performance in the aftermath of the 2000 election, the Democratic leadership chose the path of political expediency rather than mounting an earnest challenge to what ample evidence suggests may have been a widespread discrimination, fraud, tampering, and incompetence at the polls. If the truth be told, however, the time to have mounted such a challenge was immediately after the wake of Bush's coronation in January of 2001. The same Democratic Party that laughed off the Congressional Black Caucus's demands for an investigation of the Florida vote debacle also never joined the efforts to assure that all electronic voting machines be equipped to provide voter-verifiable paper receipts. A bill that would have legislated that mandate languishes even now in a congressional committee chaired by Ohio Republican Bob Ney, and the Democrats never uttered a peep of protest. Even in California, where the Secretary of State, who decertified the dubious Diebold voting machines, did so under pressure from citizens' lobbies like Bev Harris's Black Box Voting. In Ohio, the Republican Secretary of State, Ken Blackwell, who also co-chaired Bush's election committee, was forced to abandon his support of the Diebold machines under intense scrutiny brought by a nonpartisan citizen lobby, Citizens Alliance for Secure Elections. Only a handful of brave Democratic legislators like State Senator Teresa Fedor and Franklin County Commissioner Mary Jo Kilroy lent their efforts to that battle. In Ohio and Florida and a number of other states where ex-felons are punitively denied their franchise, inaccurate purges of voters suspected of being ineligible were based on lists of names generated by unscrupulous firms with close ties to the Republican Party, yet the Democrats never complained either about the policy or its overtly discriminatory implementation. Ohio's provisional ballots, whose estimated number in this election ranged from as many as 400,000 in one election night report to Secretary of State Blackwell's nationally televised figure of 250,000 in the early hours of November 3rd, and to a low of just over 130,000 the morning of Kerry's concession, still have yet to be counted. It is incredible that the number of provisional ballots in 2004 would be anything less than twice the just over 100,000 that were cast in the last presidential election. Provisional ballots are utilized primarily by people who have moved since they last registered or voted, and are therefore used primarily by people in lower income brackets or unstable neighborhoods. That would include students, a majority of African Americans, and Latinos, and displaced industrial workers, all categories that typically favor Democratic candidates. Kerry's concession and the Democrats' failure to call for an investigation or even an independent audit amount to a virtual slap in the face to those constituencies who are among the Kerry campaign's strongest supporters. for the legions of activists who, in their view, supported the Democratic candidate ostensibly for the same reasons their parents and grandparents went to war in 1945, a desperate attempt to stem the tide of global fascism, collective disbelief has been their only solace against collective despair. Many who volunteered at their local Democratic Party headquarters and found that organization in a state of disarray in the early stages of the campaign discovered firsthand the organizational erosion wrought by decades of rightward centrism and the preemptive bipartisan compromise. Traditional Democratic constituencies such as African Americans, women, and organized labor have been taken for granted for more than a generation by a Democratic leadership that has more in common with the dominant faction of the Republican Party than with even the shallow rhetoric of a succession of timid Democratic platforms. Thus, the organizational talent of those groups which the party has had to rely on have not affected the party's internal hierarchies, which have grown increasingly clueless and detached. As the complicit and uninquisitive media pundits blithely called the election for Bush, at least one predicted that the Democratic Party would now see something akin to an internal civil war, wherein its progressive wing, which conducted the bulk of the campaign work, will vie with the DLC Clintonian old guard for a turn at the helm. In many ways, that process has already begun. In hundreds of local elections where Republicans were unseated or Democrats retained their seats or ran unopposed, those legislators and judges now owe their political allegiance not to the Democratic Party as a whole, but to a progressive constituency that includes organizations like Move On and Democracy for America, which are determined to remain independent of any political parties. Democratic Party Chair Terry McAuliffe is expected to step down shortly, and many independent groups who feel betrayed by John Kerry are already beginning to target the next round of elections in 2005. And since it was the newly organized and politicized grassroots activists rather than the sluggish traditional Democratic Party machine that mobilized the majority of the new voters, a migration of the party's power base is surely an inevitable consequence. The mountain, it seems, will have to come to Muhammad after all. In the meantime, the white whale of the Democratic old guard, with John Kerry lashed to its side, will drift further out to sea as the demands for voter reform and investigation to the discrepancies of 2004 are trumpeted not by the party's leadership, but by the biggest grassroots groundswell for democracy in the United States since the civil rights movement of the 1960s. To paraphrase the words of Gil Scott-Heron, who answered the pardoning of Richard Nixon by Gerald Ford for his involvement in the Watergate break-in, "We beg your pardon, John Kerry, because the concession you gave this time was not yours to give."
No, Mr. Kerry, the concession you gave this time was not yours to give. Evan Davis there with an editorial, and he is joining us now from Ohio, as is Susan Truitt of Case in Ohio. Susan, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Evan, you're there as well, right?
Yes.
Great. So tell us, Susan, a little bit about the organizing that is going on around all of this. Evan has hinted to us that some actions and really gatherings of like-minded thinkers on this stuff is going to be happening next week.
Yes, absolutely. I am involved in a couple of different grassroots organizations, and one of those organizations is meeting with a State Senator Teresa Fetter, a Democrat from Toledo, Ohio, a Monday night at 6:30. We will be meeting at the Plumbers and Pipe Fitters Union Hall on Kinnear Road in Columbus, Ohio, for anyone in the listening area who can come. And it's to examine where we go from now, what we do about this election, and how we proceed. We're also organizing in conjunction with the a coalition of the Pissed Off Voters Association and Case Ohio, which is Citizens Alliance for Secure Elections, a public hearing on the 13th and 15th, which is a Saturday and a Monday, in Columbus, Ohio as well. And that will be at the Columbus Public Library, I believe, on Saturday. And Monday's location is still to be determined. But we will be inviting national figures on election reform issues, as well as what to do about this election and what we can do to challenge the results.
Can you tell us what exactly is happening right now? I mean, are they counting provisional ballots? And that was meant to begin at noon on Thursday, we were told. But, you know, of course, the establishment media have just abandoned the pursuit since the concession, and we don't even know what the hell is going on, frankly. But can you at least give us an idea of what's happening?
Well, unfortunately, we don't know what the hell is going on either. And you're right. The mass media has abandoned the issue. With them, the concession ended the issue, and with us, it has just begun. We would like to know, first of all, how many provisional ballots are there in Ohio? And Secretary of State Kenneth Blackwell, who has acted against the best interests of Ohio voters for months on end by trying to shove Diebold electronic voting machines down our throat, by challenging the weight of paper that voter registrations were sent in on, by imposing a very restrictive provisional balloting rule in Ohio, among very many other acts that he's taken. He's the man who's telling us how many provisional ballots there are, and the number has changed significantly, as Evan Davis's report pointed out.
And so, you know, one of the things we were talking about earlier here around the office was the idea that, okay, you know, it's not even about Kerry winning. It's really about identifying whether or not there was fraud, because someone here put it the other day, if there is fraud, that's our first article of impeachment, you know. But how serious is this? I mean, the concession's kind of immaterial, isn't it, in the face of what we're really talking about here?
Yes, I agree. I think that John Kerry's act of conceding, as Evan Davis said, was not his to give. However, even though he has conceded the election, those of us who live in this country have not conceded this election, and we are not going to go quietly into the night. And we will find out how many provisional ballots there are, and we will find out how many they're counting. In the last national election, 90% of the provisional ballots in Ohio ended up being declared valid and being counted. So if you figure that we had initially a report of 400,000 provisionals, which then dropped to 250,000 per Ken Blackwell, the Secretary of State, that's clearly enough to make up the difference between Bush and Kerry in Ohio of 136,000 votes.
Could the concession have something to do with how this negotiation goes on? I mean, is there, you know, in a way, what I was going to ask is there a time period or a statute of limitations, or are we running against a clock in all of this in any way that would allow Blackwell to stall? This was something that in 2000 arguably was very effective in context. I mean, by the time it got to the Supreme Court, of course, it sort of changed. But is there a time issue here?
Provisional ballots. Yeah, that's a very good question. And yes, the answer is yes, there is a time limit here. They have to have the provisional ballots counted and certified after 10 days. So they have up to 10 days to certify the validity of them. And
is pressure being put there on them to do that?
It's being put there by our organization, and I hope other organizations as well.
Obviously, you're a relatively small organization compared with, say, the Democratic Party, which
yes.
It would be really nice to have their help on this one.
But
I heard Evan was telling me earlier today that perhaps Ralph Nader might be marshaled into this. And are there others who are getting involved in this? Have you put a call out for attorneys or people to get engaged in this?
Yes, we're reaching out to everyone we can. I've just spoken with a local representative of Common Cause. I've spoken with people at the Electronic Frontier Foundation in San Francisco. I intend to contact True Majority. They've all been very, very helpful in the past with Ohio's battles for free and fair elections. I expect them to step up to the plate yet again, as they always do. Also, it is true that Ralph Nader has indicated that he is interested in challenging the vote in the 34 states in which he was on the ballot. Unfortunately, Ohio was not one of those states. And he was waiting to see if there was a groundswell of support from activists throughout the country in order for him to proceed with that.
But that's so hard because of this anvil of weight that the establishment media is dropping on the shoulders of everybody and telling them just to not pay attention, right? I mean, it must be very difficult to attract people to this movement. A lot of people I know are depressed. They're feeling like, a bit taken, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And depression is the word of the day. People were physically ill the day after the election that I know, and it's been really difficult to get people sort of back on track and thinking about what can be done. So, yes, it's been hard to mobilize people. Action is needed immediately. We appreciate all of the media attention, and I so very much appreciate you broadcasting this, because the more the word gets out that there are questions that need to be answered, the more likely we will get the answers eventually.
Yeah, we've seen incredible damage control by the Republicans during this time, saying, well, the 3 million in the popular vote means it doesn't really matter which way Ohio goes. The opposite argument they made back in 2000, I might add, right,
yes.
That the popular vote went the other way. And we have other issues, too, enormous issues with these touchscreen voting machines that could have a hand in that 3 million. And there have been some Freedom of Information Act requests made, I think. Do you know anything about those?
Yes. Actually, I was on a radio panel yesterday with Andy Stevenson, who works with Bev Harris of blackboxvoting.org, and they sent out FOIA, or Freedom of Information, requests to every county in the country, which I just applaud, and I'm amazed that they did that, and I'm very grateful that they did. So, yes, Bev Harris is working diligently on uncovering as much information as she can, and, of course, at least one of her anecdotes that she has thus far is one of the audits on an electronic voting machine, and not in Ohio, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the state, but it had a three-hour gap.
Right. Let me explain what that means. Bev Harris, long in advance of this election, pointed out that there's a kind of a software glitch issue with these machines. It's the software called GEMS, G-E-M-S, and it allows a batch conversion of votes with a simple hack. Now this language may not mean anything to listeners who don't know much about computing. What I mean to say is, very easily, if you have access to the devices for even a short amount of time, you can change large chunks or large numbers of votes with the simple click of a mouse, or a couple of clicks of a mouse, and typing in different figures. The fact that this existed all the way through Kevin Shelley's 23 points of resistance to these machines, and all the way through all of the different people who tried to stop this paperless voting to happen, really makes it a point of culpability here. And what she is trying to do is to find out whether or not the audit log, which is the electronic log that says what the machines were doing, has any gaps in it. That is to say, there was a period of time when it was unaccounted for. And does that pretty much describe what you mean about this anecdotal information?
That's exactly right. And you did a good job of summarizing it. The GEM system is used primarily with ES&S Corporation, which is one of the main vendors in the country. And ES&S is owned by a brother who owns Diebold. So Diebold and ES&S, in my mind, are cut from the same cloth. And Franklin County, Ohio, where I live, for instance, we have DREs. They've had them for 9 years. They're Danaher's, which used to be Shooptronics. But the tabulation machinery in Franklin County, Columbus, Ohio, is ES&S. And although they assured us that it does not have the GEMS capability, I don't know that they really knew what they were talking about when we asked. Yes, I think that the fact that Ohio had seven counties that had prior DREs in place, the direct record electronic or electronic voting machines, raises issues of the validity of the count, because there is always the possibility of some sort of tampering involved when you have a paperless trail, or rather a paperless DRE.
And it would be very simple to do, especially if you had a hot-button item that was very divided, like, for example, gay marriage, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, that might be an extension of what we're talking about here, because, of course, this is really implicating or alleging corruption in all of this. But we're theorizing this out, and the reality is that it's in many ways the perfect situation if there are gaps in the audit log with which to maybe make some accusations, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it raises enough questions that it has to be examined. Another thing that we found out is purportedly there were 2,000, and this may not be an accurate figure, but this is what I am being told by people who have sources, 2,000 voting machines held back in Franklin County in the warehouse. And that we had 4 to 5 hour waits in line in Franklin County. Now, Franklin County went for Kerry, but, you know, we're talking popular vote, we're talking about, you know, getting the vote count up. We had hundreds and hundreds of people leaving the line after waiting for hours and never being able to vote in Franklin County. And I know the story was consistent throughout the state. The voter turnout was extraordinary, but they knew it was going to be extraordinary. And we went down to the Board of Elections to ask, why couldn't you have deployed more machines? And they told us at the time that they were holding back some machines in case some of them broke down. Well, they never told us at that time it was 2,000. It was a figure that I found out later.
It's really amazing to hear what's going on, especially when you turn on your television and everybody has just moved on.
Yes.
It's really a crazy time we're living in. Susan Truitt, I thank you for joining us. Anything else to let our listeners know about as this goes on? I think I really want to make sure that you get out the information for people to contact you or to assist, especially attorneys who want to weigh in on this stuff.
Absolutely.
Do you want to give that out?
Our website is Case Ohio. That's C-A-S-E, ohio.org. And I would welcome any input and any help that people are willing to give.
Evan, do you want to final thoughts? I know we've had a 6-minute editorial from you, so perhaps it's a bit ridiculous to ask, but anything else you want to throw in here?
Sure, that's fine. Well, you know, it's just kind of incredible to me that this issue is just now coming up, because we've had 4 years or more to anticipate it, and especially given some of the work that Case and Susan and even Free Speech Radio News have done in investigating this and trying to expose the...
Well, now, hang on. Now, Evan, let me interrupt you, because what this points to is collusion to me. I'll tell you why. Look, this administration got into power, and they said, oh, yeah, the 2000 was really bad. We'll help you. We'll pass HAVA. You know what I mean? I mean, this has been, every step of the way, they have worked hard to make sure it's even worse this time around, right? Because they see themselves as losing the numbers, I think. No?
Well, of course, I agree with you. What I was complaining about was the lack of reaction to this developing collusion that we've had ample evidence of. I mean, back in the summer, I remember interviewing Wally O'Dell, the CEO of Diebold, for a Free Speech Radio News report, and he point-blank told me and the pool of reporters that were interviewing him there at a shareholders meeting in Canton that there were no federal guidelines that gave parameters for producing electronic voting machines that produce paper voter verifiable paper receipts. And that's simply not true, because there are other vendors that already offer those machines, and yet the Secretary of State favored the Diebold machines and at one point had required all of Ohio's counties to purchase them.
Bingo. And that's, that's what they did all over the country. They used HAVA to make these Diebold guys go out and say, you better do this. You got to be in compliance with HAVA. You better buy these machines. They're good. They're fine. Don't worry. They fit all the federal regulations. You know what I mean? And they pushed them down the faces of these counties.
That's right. That's absolutely right. When we went out to the counties were baffled. And they were saying, we don't understand why we have to buy these things. We've never had trouble with our punch cards. You know, we've never had trouble with our paper ballots. So I agree with you. I think that they were crammed down throats.
Well, I Susan Truitt, Evan Davis. I'm sorry, I cut you off, Evan. Did you want to get anything else into this mix?
Oh, no, that's fine. That's fine.
I'm just so hopping mad right now.
As we all should be.
But I thank you both for joining us today, and we'll be in touch in the next day or two, and do keep us abreast of what is happening in your state, will you?
Thank you so much. We will.
Take care.
Thanks.
And that is Susan Truitt of Case Ohio. They're at caseohio.org, and Evan Davis, our man in Ohio. As you've been hearing, Rahul Mahajan has been here, and I've got this marvelous conversation that we had earlier, and I want to play it for you right now. So check this out, just so that the Nation magazine can't accuse me of not doing what everybody else is doing, you know what I mean? Joined now by Rahul Mahajan, and we've been having conversations all around this building. I know you've been talking to a lot of folks here, too. I'm excited that you're here. Welcome to KPFK.
Well, it's great to be here with you.
So a couple of days out of this election, and we still don't fully know what has happened in terms of the mechanics, but maybe we don't focus on that right now, and we let that kind of play itself out. What about the agenda that's meant to come now in West Asia? What do you envision specifically? There's a lot of talk going around and rumors.
Let's start with the most clear thing. There's been all this talk over did Bush get a mandate, did he not? It's meaningless talk. It's irrelevant. Bush claimed a mandate. He claimed it very firmly today, and he has now the power to carry it through. He said basically more or less, I'm going to reach out in the following sense. I know what I'm going to do, and I'm going to reach out to you to get you to support what I do. Not reach out in terms of forming some joint agenda. He said, the people have spoken, and they're behind me, and I'm going to do exactly what I've planned to do. And I do think that there's going to be a lot of focus in the next period on the domestic agenda, but there's also these ramifications for the foreign policy. One of the obvious things is, of course, we know there's this brewing assault on Fallujah, and it's going to be much more no holds barred this time. The main countering force there that might keep them within some bounds is worrying about the political reaction in Iraq, but they're not going to worry about an American public reaction right now. They're going to say they've spoken, they're behind us, and we can do anything to the people of Fallujah, and they're not going. Americans aren't going to pay attention.
Does this affect the election? That is to say, are we right now in this bombing of Fallujah not only gaining strategic ground per se against the resistance, but are we actually bombing parts of the electorate out of the mix, as it were? There is some conversation about the election in January being an opportunity for Iraqis to send the troops away if they organize it in a certain way. Do you think some of that is at play in this attack?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned the electorate, because just now, development reported only today in the New York Times is that supposedly the Iraqi government has decided, against the advice of the UN, to include the votes of Iraqi expatriates in their so-called elections in January. Nobody ever does this. I mean, you're talking about votes of people living in another country, some of whom have been out of this country for decades, with much more difficulties about counting and fraud and you name it.
Would that include the United States?
Yes, all expatriate Iraqis. And supposedly, according to the Times, the U.S. government was opposed to this plan, and Alawi okayed it, and obviously that's nonsense. This plan greatly helps the plans of the Bush administration to claim that the election results are legitimate, and of course most of the expatriates are much more likely to vote for whoever the U.S.-backed candidates are.
It's so two-faced when you think about Palestine, right? The diaspora of Palestine, they're being told through the Geneva Accords that they should just forget about the right of return.
Absolutely. Meanwhile, there's no consistent principles here except whatever serves the United States and the Bush administration immediately in the short term. And so in terms of Fallujah, I think bombing the electorate is a minor thing. I mean, the number of people you actually kill in these things is not huge by the standards of the population of the whole town, although it may be getting there, because last time it was 1,000 out of 200,000. This time maybe it's 5,000. I mean, we don't know. It's a large number. But more importantly is that the election is the excuse for the military assault on Fallujah, which has nothing to do with the election. It has everything to do with beating the armed resistance.
I guess what I meant is, does it have anything to do with Shia, Sunni, or sectarian relationships? That's what I mean. Do you think we're going to see a calculated effort by the Americans to eliminate certain kinds of people that I've been calling electorate here in this conversation?
My immediate guess is probably not. And the last time they assaulted Fallujah was also the same time they assaulted the Mahdi army, and they actually built numerous bonds of Shia-Sunni solidarity that hadn't existed before, which were manifested in August when they were fighting the Mahdi army in Najaf, and you had parts of the Sunni Mujahideen came down to Najaf and did tactical training for the Mahdi army. So I think in terms of that sort of agenda of keeping Shia and Sunni split, the assault on Fallujah isn't going to serve that particularly well. But there are also a number of other things, of course, to the regional agenda of the United States right now, and it's some kind of, you know, it obviously some higher power is playing a hand here, when at the same time that Bush claims his mandate, Yasser Arafat is dying. And there is the possibility of a major new offensive on Palestine. We've seen a lot
they've
already.
They've sent Abbas there. Yeah. There's a guy who's been rejected as a spy, you know? Like, it's unbelievable what we're seeing now, right?
Yes. It is, and they had this plan called the Roadmap, which was actually a plan not for a negotiated settlement, the way some people want to think, but a plan to create a Palestinian Quisling government, an explicitly Quisling government, much like Arafat was after the Oslo Accord was passed, except even more so, and Abu Mazen was the man to be their Quisling. And the reason the Roadmap failed is not any of the things that is usually mentioned, but because Abu Mazen was not sufficiently willing to betray people. But now you have Arafat dying, some kind of power struggle in the offing in Palestine, where the United States and Israel will both have a tremendous amount of leverage, separately and together. And you see at the same time the Israeli plans for the so-called Gaza withdrawal, the building of the fence, the cementing of the West Bank occupation, and you can tell there's going to be a whole, and the massive invasion of northern Gaza that concluded just a few months ago, and you see the potential for really major systemic changes there as well.
The slow grinding end of the one-state solution, right? That conversation is long gone now. I mean, far off the table, right? I mean, this has been the era, 96 to 2004, of the end of the one-state solution in the region, right?
Well, I mean, the thing is that it's been also the era of the end of the two-state solution, because the Israelis have literally taken over so much of the West Bank now.
So the birth of the Bantustan, in other words.
Exactly. So there's no separate Palestinian state that is politically feasible to create in terms of even internal Israeli politics. An immediate one state obviously doesn't work with such highly polarized populations. But more and more people are talking about a one state over the long term. Even people in the PLO are starting to talk about one state again the way some of them did in the 1970s. So what we're seeing is, we've seen for now 3 years, the siege on Palestinians, the slow grinding them down into poverty, the closures, which are actually a much bigger story even than the invasions, which have resulted in malnutrition in Palestine at a level almost equaling that in Iraq under the sanctions.
And much of this happened under Clinton, the building of Highway 6, the separation and the change of the entire culture. You can't even travel the 40 kilometers from Hebron to Ramallah anymore. So you have the change in family patterns. You have This is really.
You have basic changes in access to food and medical care, too. And these are reported in UN reports, but almost unreported in the U.S. media. Even the ones that do decent coverage of the invasions and so on are not reporting this stuff. And now you have the question, this is all building, and what's the next step? And I think we see more invasions of the kind of the northern Gaza invasion coming down the pike, and we see a lot less restraint for Israel now once Bush has claimed his mandate.
Well, now let's go to the region. A lot of people are talking about Iran, and much has been made of this euro petrocurrency question around me lately. Many people were talking about the fact that Saddam Hussein wanted to go to the euro to deal in oil in 2000 in advance of the election, and that might have played a hand in all of this stuff, and that Iran, the Tehran government, has created an oil management system which will allow them to go to the euro rather than the dollar turning to Europe. I had an Iranian tell me the other day, this is the beginning of the U.S. war with Europe. What about Iran and this type of a conversation?
Okay, so in 2000, Iraq changed over its oil sales to be denominated in euros. And the global oil market is denominated in dollars, which acts as a source of constant demand for dollars, and this props up the price of the dollar. Although, as you know, if you follow the markets, there are lots of pressures that draw the price of the dollar down, the trade deficit being the biggest one. Iraq went over to denominating oil in euros for a very specific reason. It saw the United States as the enemy keeping the sanctions on correctly, and said this is a symbolic, and not purely symbolic, but at least partly symbolic act we're taking against them.
And to be clear, it was 82. It was trading at 82 cents on the dollar at the time, and they took a loss. I mean, an 18 cent loss on it. So it was clearly a gesture, a power gesture, right? I mean,
it was very much a power gesture. It's not really about money. It's about simply which center of financial power do you placate, basically. And after did Iran and Venezuela started talking about the same thing. The U.S., the war in Iraq has so polarized the world that it's actually made a lot of countries start reconsidering, because it's not just a question of oil. There's the denomination of oil in dollars or euros. There's also the fact that all third world countries have to keep substantial amount of foreign currency reserves. And again, there, do you keep it in dollars or do you keep it in euros? And there's a lot that are now thinking about keeping it in euros, partly because of the advent of the euro in 2000 and partly because as a statement against the United States.
Well, they're tied together. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It seems that the American economy, with all of its deficits very high, is very much becoming a false economy in many ways. But is this enough, you see? There are radicals who are saying that's why they had to go in and take Saddam out and get the oil flowing so they could cut it up, and that's why they're going to go into Iran.
This is just way overblown. This is on the same level as saying that one pipeline that UNICAL wanted was a reason to go to war with Afghanistan. These are small factors in a much, much larger picture. And it is control of the oil, and especially of oil that is going to be increasingly important in the world economy as other sources start to run out. I mean, if you look at, the production to reserves ratio for OPEC countries, especially Middle East countries, is much lower than the production to reserves ratio of most other oil producers. Russia and others and Venezuela even are going to run out much more quickly than Iraq and Saudi Arabia. That oil will become more and more important, and the neoconservatives are basically neo-colonials who believe that their way to control the countries of this crucially important region, crucially important because of its energy resources, is not simply to take existing regimes and put constraints on them and twist their arms behind closed doors and get them to go along. It is to go in and raise those regimes to the ground and rebuild your own colonial regime. That's what they've tried to do in Iraq. The point is, however, that they have failed. They are failing miserably, and I don't see any way they can succeed in doing it, even in Iraq. And everyone now understands this, except possibly George Bush. I think even some of the neocons understand this. Even the Weekly Standard, for that matter, criticizes the Bush administration on its handling of colonialism in Iraq. And so to imagine that they can even dream at this point of doing this kind of thing in Iran or even in Syria, which would be a much easier target, but is not worth so much to them, it's not going to happen. There are going to be a lot of military posturing. There may even be strikes possibly by Israel on Iran's nuclear plans.
Or really, on Iran, you mean?
Yes, because, you know, the question of Iran's nuclear program has come up majorly. And at the same time as it becomes a big question, you've got Israel, you know, buying large numbers of American smart bombs, and the real possibility that Israel will be kind of used, you know, the way it do a similar thing like it did to Iraq in 1981 with the attack on the Osirak nuclear reactor. Do something like that in Iran. It's entirely possible. It's also possible they'll decide not to do it because it can't be a prelude to a full-scale invasion of Iran, which is simply not militarily possible now.
But 1 year from today, we have 140,000 troops in Iraq, and how many in Afghanistan?
American troops in Afghanistan are much lower.
25,000?
10 or 12,000.
Okay, so what 1 year from now, these two countries that sandwich Iran, how many American troops can we expect to see there at that
time?
Well,
see, that's the thing. You have a U.S. military encirclement of Iran, and the neoconservatives were very open about this. They were open about it even before. They said once we have the war in Iraq completed, we will have Iran encircled. And so encirclement gives you a great deal of political leverage short of having to invade.
Well, embargo is very easy then, isn't it?
Embargo is trivial. If they want to stop Iran from exporting oil, they just have to snap their fingers and they're doing it. Hmm. They're all in place to do it.
What is the strategic advantage of the encirclement then that I'm
not sure? The strategic advantage is several things. One is the United States, under the Clinton administration, very deliberately and for largely domestic political reasons, took itself out of the Iranian oil market. In 1996, they passed the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act, which made it illegal for U.S. corporations to invest more than $40 million in Iran's energy sector. Of course, $40 million from oil companies, nothing. What that meant in practice was, since they were unilateral sanctions, not international sanctions, that the U.S. took itself out of the game and let the EU go, and the EU has invested heavily in Iranian oil. Now, someone like Dick Cheney, who spent a lot of time lobbying against the Iran sanctions when he was CEO of Halliburton, he sees this as a big problem. And how do we reverse this? Well, a military encirclement is a good starting point for exerting leverage that the EU simply cannot match.
So instead of looking at it like U.S. versus Europe, maybe it's better to look at it like Total versus Chevron or FINA versus Exxon, right? Mobil or something like that.
In part, it's that. That is part of the larger U.S. versus Europe picture, and it's the one that plays out most clearly in the Middle East. Yeah.
What about other fronts? North Korea and the continuing idea of disarmament wars, the thing that Blix said could not work. And what about the continuing construction of these things like we've seen in Tanzania and Kenya, these fortresses that they've set up as sort of bases? Rumor has it they want them all around the Caspian Sea. What do you think about this kind of stuff?
Disarmament wars are right now, I think, really not something that's likely to happen. I mean, they never were purely disarmament wars, right? We know the weapons of mass destruction aren't the reason they went to war in Iraq.
Right, true.
But also there's the fact that because of that, it's now the political credibility you'd have in trying to launch another one is zero, is negative. I mean, they become even more of a laughing stock than they would be. With regard to North Korea in particular, the problem is that it probably actually has the weapons. Had Iraq had nuclear weapons, then there's no way the U.S. could have done what it did. So the neocons' plan for North Korea has always been do these multilateral talks, the idea of which is to get China and Russia and Japan more, and South Korea, if possible, more on the side of the United States, and to build credibility and to build the possibility between all of them of creating an economic encirclement and siege of North Korea, which could collapse quite quickly under economic pressures. There is no plan of beating North Korea militarily, because it would be disastrous to try, and they know that. They are afraid of doing that. And that's, by the way, the main reason why Bush is so in favor of multilateral talks. You know, Bush, the unilateralist, wants multilateral talks, and Kerry, the so-called multilateralist, right, wants bilateral talks. That's the main reason, because they need these other countries in order to complete an economic and political encirclement of North Korea. That's been the plan all along.
I want to move to something else, but you're making me think of Japan real quick. Japan, mm-hmm, attempting to become permanent members of the UN Security Council, and a lot of their decision-making being wrapped up in that. I'm talking about catering to the United States in some ways, and other, mm-hmm, things too. Do you think that's correct, and are they trying to perhaps divorce themselves from some of this type of manipulation? How do you see Japan in all of this?
I've found it hard to see Japan as an independent factor and an independent actor. I think even to this day, you know, almost 60 years after the occupation of Japan started, they still are politically very much an occupied country, and they don't differ very much from the U.S. on foreign policy. Even while the people were dramatically against the Iraq War, to like 80% of them, the government was subservient and servile to the United States, and that's normal for Japan. I don't see very much of a divergence there, but of course the Japan is not into this crazy neoconservative plan for regime change in North Korea, and in order to move forward, they'd have to bring them on board more. I don't see the particular push for the Security Council enlargement as really an arena of conflict there, and in fact, the United States has generally been in favor of Security Council enlargement with key, carefully selected new members as a counterbalance to China, France, Germany. I mean, China, France, and Russia.
Russia, right. Yeah, Russia. Interesting. And, okay, my last piece is in your book, Full Spectrum Dominance, you said something I think very important about the movement here and its relationship to movements outside. I mean, movements against a war and so on. Right now, we have a situation where this election was either rigged to the teeth or a complete failure. And so I think about elections as one means, well, maybe not. The other thing is I compare it to 72 and how Nixon was reelected, then they went after him very hard. And it strikes me you have four opportunities for articles of impeachment here if you could attract them. One, voter fraud in 2004. Two, the illegal wars and the violation of the Geneva Conventions in Abu Ghraib and other places. Three, well, if you want to go here, 9/11, I don't know, but massive failures of intelligence. And then four, the possibility of voter fraud in 2000 or something like that. Is impeachment a direction that Americans and the movement here should turn its attention to? What do you say now, given that the movement here has utterly failed or been cheated out of its success?
Number four, the voter fraud in 2000, I don't think you can literally pin on Bush. You could pin it on Jeb Bush, but not on George. Number three, 9/11, I think it's too difficult. You'd have to show clear malfeasance as opposed to incompetence. Numbers one and two, the voter fraud in 2004, all the attempts at suppression of democracy, the illegal war in Iraq, the lying to the public about it, the violation of the Geneva Conventions. Beyond that, even the violation of basic ideas like the right of habeas corpus, even of U.S. citizens, all of these, I think, constitute very clearly high crimes and misdemeanors. And Bush obviously deserves to be impeached. Now, when I say this, I'm not saying we focus on a movement to impeach Bush. That would be a political loser and a mistake. We need to talk about the impeachment of Bush, but the House is dominated by the Republicans, and there's no direct way. What you need is an indirect way, which is you focus on the occupation of Iraq and the fact that it's a failure, the fact that it cost American lives, the fact that it's cost so much in American morality, in our own sense of an ordinary person, of us as a moral people. Abu Ghraib really, really hit that hard, but the lesson wasn't followed up properly. You focus on all these things, you build an anti-war movement, and again, in the case of Nixon, if not for the anti-Vietnam War movement, if not for the explosion in protests over the invasion of and the bombing of Cambodia, then the Watergate burglary itself might not have been exactly an epic-making transformative event.
We must create the environment in
exactly
which he can be nailed, right?
Absolutely. And that can be done because this Iraq war is the biggest U.S. failure. And I don't mean a moral failure. They make moral failures all along. It's their biggest political failure since the Vietnam War.
Mahul Mahajan, thank you so much.
It's great to be with you.
as a man, where you gonna run to?
MTP Arctic Elections Hot Wired, in effect, back next week, too, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 2 o'clock. Join us for that tonight. Axis of Justice at 7. And, of course, Spaceways and DFR. DFR on the money all the way through this election, by the way. Definitely tune them in tonight. The full music block.
The sea will be boiling when you run to the sea.
My thanks to Alan Minsky and to my guests Susan Truitt and Evan Davis and to Rahul Mahajan. What a brilliant cat this guy is. I'm late, I'm running out. Take care, and we'll see you Monday, and don't hurt anybody this weekend. David Barsamian and Alternative Radio is next.
Oh. 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 O